Colonel Offred Reel 2. So driving and maintenance, give me the breakdown on that.
Well, this was really an excellent, this sort of training, both driving and maintenance and the gunnery, was quite excellent. Tremendously high standard of NCO instructors who really taught you from A to Z the internal combustion engine and its application both to the armoured car, the Rolls-Royce armoured car, and the then tank, the medium, the Vickers medium. Mm. And it really was, you started that, as I couldn't even drive in those days, you see. Not only did I learn to drive, I suppose after a fashion, but I learned everything about the internal combustion engine, dynamos, motors, and that sort of thing. Mm. And
how was that done? Did they, you had workshops and you'd take them to pieces?
No, this was very largely NCO instructor to six students. And if it came to dynamo, well, then he took it to pieces on the bench, or a magneto and that sort of thing, which was a very real thing, because you reckon that a first driver, anything went wrong with the magneto, took the bloody thing off and put it right. So that really was, by the time you finished that, you really were pretty competent in the everyday maintenance, I'll say, and putting things right on the IC engine and later the tank. First class. Anything else on that?
Well, the driving, how were you introduced to the tank, and what kind of exercises did you have on the driving side to qualify?
The exercises, the first driving was done on a Rolls-Royce tender. All had a crack at that. And then the next thing was onto the tank, and of course that driving was pretty well all cross-country over the jumps and that sort of thing.
That must have been quite an interesting episode.
Alarming, yeah. For chaps like myself who'd never driven before.
Well, tell me a bit about what kind of things happened to you in your driving course.
Well, if you missed your gears and you're going up a bloody great hill, you started to go backwards. A bit of a panic went on, but we seemed to get over it all right. There was no desperate sort of accidents or anything like that at all. So I say it's largely because the NCO instructors were so really superlative.
Where were the courses that you drove?
All across the driving ground at Bovington. There were no road circuits you could drive on because they're only about one car width, you see, I suppose. I don't remember driving on road circuits, but certainly cross-country, and both the armoured cars and the tanks.
Were the courses that you drove specially constructed in any way with particular obstacles?
Oh, yes, yeah. As well as the ordinary sort of round and round business, straight driving. They had the obstacles on, which had been, of course, man-made, bulldozed and dips and quite smart hills and things like that.
And what proportion of your time was devoted to driving Rolls-Royce cars, and what proportion to the medium Mark IIs?
Well, I think you drove a Rolls-Royce until they thought you were good enough to go on. So a chap who already had a motor car and could drive, he naturally did less on the Rolls than a chap like myself who was learning from scratch.
Did you find the transition from car to tank difficult to make?
I think probably easier,
really?
In a way.
Why was
that? You had more room, you know, and I think you weren't on a road and that sort of thing, you see. It was quite tricky for a novice, I must confess, because they were a little bit, compared with the modern tank driving, you know, the gears and the steering and that sort of thing were much more difficult, of course.
What did you find were the main adjustments you had to make from the car to the tank?
I didn't know enough about a car driving anyway to know that I'd make any adjustments.
Okay.
As a result of all this, Christ, I bought a motor car and got in the bloody thing and drove to Bournemouth and back, you know. So they must have given one enough to make you roadworthy.
Let's talk a bit about the gunnery. What weapons were you trained on?
The 3-pounder, the Vickers machine gun, the pistol. And that was all. The NCO instructors were real experts, And you learnt the, on the Vickers gun, you learnt the various stoppages and the maintenance of it and the preparation for firing in absolute detail, you know, packing the cannula and the gland and things like that. And it was really very good indeed. And that, the same on the two-pounder, the loading, and that was subsequently followed, of course, by firing.
Yeah. So, tell me about the firing. How was that done?
The firing was all done from the two-pounder, from the three-pounder. It was all done on the move. When I was there, they didn't have any light tanks, of course. They only had medium tanks. Mm. And again, the Vickers gun firing, the coaxial, that was all done on the move.
Can you detail that a bit more from the point of view of the actual drills and the ranges of firing and things like that?
The sort of, they call the stock, what we call the box run, was a run from starting at 500 metres, 500 yards from the target, down to 300. That was the head-on at the target. Then you turned left, you fired broadside on for about a 200 or 300 yard run. Then you turned tail on to complete three sides of the box, doing tail end shooting. So in that you did the forward shooting, broadside shooting, shooting over the rail. And then they did have, the last stage of it was a battle practice, which was a sort of more or less unknown run. You were just kept between the flags or whatever it was, and took on targets as they came into view. That's what it was, really.
I see, yes. Was there plenty of ammunition? Was there plenty of opportunity to fire the gun, or were you restricted?
I think there was sufficient ammunition to make a chap a qualified gunner.
I mean, how many rounds of the gun would you in fact shoot in
this
training?
I'd find impossible to remember now. I should think that each gunner must have had about, well, I suppose, 15 rounds of three-pounder, and probably about four belts of Vickers, that's 1,000 rounds, that sort of thing.
And now you said all the firing training was, all the gunnery training was done on the move. What was your impression of your accuracy by the time you had gone through that
course? Quite good. Quite good, of course, but it was doctored or tailored in as much that you had, for instance, your head-on run, well, say, 200 yards, 200 yards. Now, you had a certain time to do that. So what you did, you went like a bat out of hell. In fact, even starting the starting point on the move, going flat out, roaring down to the bottom, about 10 yards from the end of the run, slowed the driver right down, so he was just moving, and then you fired. So you were damn nearly firing from a stationary pattern. But this is sort of a one-upmanship, gamesmanship, I suppose, whatever you like. Mm. This is how, in fact, it went.
Yes.
Then, on the broadside run, when you fired the Vickers as well, you didn't have quite so much time. You had to fire the whole way. Mm. But you reserved your three-pounder just to the very end of the run, where you really got him slowed up and got as many offs as you could.
Were you given at the time any explanation about why the focus of the gunnery training was firing on the move as opposed to static?
I never really questioned it until I got to a regiment. And then I tackled my CO, Justice Tilley, and told him my concern, because the funny thing about this gunnery, you see, that in civilian life you get experts on radio, D&M, but you don't get experts on gunnery. Or chaps. Now, I think it must be that to be on tank gunnery, anyway, possibly in sort of gunnery, but certainly on tank gunnery, it appears to me you have to have a particular sort of mentality or brain, outlook, because it's quite remarkable to me, here am I, an absolutely uneducated individual who became alleged to be a hell of a gunnery expert, and could think of things in gunnery techniques which other chaps would never strike them in a day's march. I still don't know why it is.
Hmm. That being the case, by the time you had completed this gunnery course, and looking at it from the point of view of your, well, looking at it from the point of view of the time, how would you assess it? Do you think it was a good training, the gunnery training?
Mechanically, excellent. But the firing, for its application for war, not so hot, because it didn't work like that. Now, this was the fallacy. When I got to my regiment, I got to Justice Tilley, my CO, and told him my doubts about the sense of this firing on the move. And I said, you far better get 100% hits if you fired stationary. And his answer to that was, well, if you can fire on the move, you can certainly fire stationary. Now, of course, this is a fallacy, because when you're firing on the move, you either shake them on, or if you miss, it's because of the movement of the platform and so on. But with stationary shooting, it's absolutely meticulous. And if you miss, there's something wrong. You can't blame anything else.
Mm.
It's either the range or the aim or the coincidence of gun and sights or what have you. So if we'd been firing stationary from fire positions, then, of course, I think the standard would have been higher of actual shooting.
At the end of this training at Bovington, did you complete it with any clear impression of what you were being trained for? I mean, what roles you were being trained for?
No, only other than the fact that you're going to fight a tank, and the condition would be a bit thing, and excitable, you see, because chaps get very excitable when they really are in war, in a moving tank, and it's a matter of keeping the crew control. I think it's still true to say, and the thing that I've struggled against for many years, is there is this business in a tank of fire orders, when you apply fire and how you apply it, getting the gunner on to the right target and so on. It's all done very much as not an automatic drill, but as a drill. Whereas in war, of course, there's a tremendous amount of encouragement and that sort of thing for the crew and calming them down and things like that, you know, so they don't flap and make a nonsense.
Mm.
Which, of course, I suppose you can't feed in peacetime training, I suppose is the answer.
I'm very interested in that you say that the role you felt you were being trained for was to fight tanks. Do you mean also then to say that no suggestion was given during the training that one of the tanks' role might have been to support infantry?
When I said that, I mean fighting from a tank.
Oh, I see.
Fighting from a tank. Mm-hmm.
When I asked the original question, I'm...
Put it like this. I would say that 80% the thought was fighting tanks, and the other 20% was fighting infantry.
Mm.
That was your machine gun, which of course is a hell of a gun, really.
Mm.
Your coaxial machine gun is so well sighted, the sighting is so good and so on, it's very accurate, up to its limited range. But what the thing could never be complete, of course, because we didn't have either the gun or the ammunition to fight anything that was dug in.
Yeah.
This was the lack of the HE round,
mm.
which we felt right through until we got the American tank in 42.
Mm. Before you, after you left Bovington and before you were attached to a battalion, I believe there was a young officer's course that you were sent to at Woolwich.
Yes.
Who provided the course at Woolwich and where was it given?
It was provided by the Royal Military College of Science. The thing that is true of them now, and this is entirely a gunner establishment with a very large number of civilian instructors, and they taught the various subjects like they do now, of course, the sort of engines, engine testings, and the gunners themselves, of course, do the gunnery side. We never touched. We simply did the engine side, really. The motor mechanic side. there for 6 months, and tremendous theory with the math that go to it, you see, with the slide rule and all this sort of business, which of course is very difficult for chaps like ourselves, who, you know, only ambition was getting a bloody tank and roar around the countryside and fight the thing perhaps eventually. What application all this slide rule and mathematical approach could have to our particular way of life.
I'm still not clear what the content of the course was. It was about engines primarily.
Engines, strength of materials, engine testing, things like that. We're touching a little on things like, although it was almost a myth then, infrared. I can remember now and then seeing an infrared photograph taken across the channel. Never heard another thing about it, of course, for donkey's years. The end of the war.
Did it strike you as at all curious that gunnery wasn't included in the theoretical training you had at Woolwich?
Well, not really, because the gunner's gunnery is entirely different to ours. Ours being direct shooting and theirs being indirect shooting with all the mathematical approach to it, you know, to get the shell down at the right place. Whereas ours should be, you see the target and you hit it by just saying do the rifle direct fire.
This course, what was it, a standard part of young officers' training?
Standard part of young officers' training, introduced, I think, about, I think we were about the third course to go on it. And this went on until, I think, the RAC were formed.
I see, yes. After you left Woolwich, how did you come to be allocated to your battalion? What procedures were...
Matter of choice.
Whose choice?
Well, one's own choice, provided you passed in the thing high enough to get what you wanted. So I opted for 5th Tanks, simply because they're... Well, put it like this. I didn't want to go to the 3rd at Lydd in the shingle. I didn't want to go to the 2nd. They were at Farnborough, and they were chaps who roared up and down to town, which didn't really interest me. I didn't want to go to the 4th. They were at Catterick, because they were I-Tanks. So, really, that left me with the 5th. I put that as my first choice and went there. And so the other chaps went to the battalions as they were left for them.
Yes. And the choice of battalions was largely left to the officer himself.
The officer, yes. And if he passed high enough in his order of courses, then he got it. So if I hadn't got the 5th, I'd have had to go on to one of the others.
So at a certain level of passing, you could choose your battalion, and below that you got what you were given. In making the choice, you've explained to me the criterion by which you made your choice. Did other people apply the same kind of criteria?
I think so, yes. I think so.
I wondered if the sort of sporting reputations or the professional reputations of the battalions
affect the issue, but then I think probably if I wanted to... say, go to somebody who was that much better at Rugger, I might have gone to the 2nd at Farnborough. But the fact that I went to where I did was entirely my own choice, because it suited me either geographically or anything you like, you know. And colour, which one knew one was on the plane the whole bloody summer, you see, from, well, March till beginning of October. You were tanking and you know, under canvas and that sort of thing, you see, so... being at Perham, you were more or less there anyway.
Last time we talked about this, you gave me the impression that you were sort of spotted a bit for your rugby playing ability by the 5th, who encouraged
you. No.
I got hold the wrong end.
End of the stick, because you see, when I was two of my batch had rugby blues. That's two of the four of us had rugby blues. And there are other officers at the depot who are quite good rugby. We played the 5th. The depot, when I was a young officer there, played the 5th about a fortnight before I joined them. And I said, we beat them by 30 points 3 or 30 points 11, something like that. There's no question. These 5th Tanks were novices. There's no question going to them as a rugger playing outfit. Didn't enter into it.
Once you got to the 5th, You did play rugby for them, I believe.
Oh, yes.
Was the rugby taken fairly seriously?
Not when I got there.
No.
But then, as soon as you started to get success, you know, the whole battalion became rugger supporters, as it were, you see. Mm. It's entirely a matter of that with soldiers, that if you're successful, they're all for it.
To what extent did the rugby team draw on the officers of the battalion, and to what extent on the NCOs and other ranks?
This varies, of course. If I'd gone to the Duke of Wellington's regiment, there'd been 8 officers playing. With my own lot, I tried to get various officers in, but they just weren't good enough. And so the first year I had one other fellow in, who was quite a useful player, probably just worth his place, because he did know the game, and he wasn't a novice like so many of them. And he was a good athlete anyway. He played that year, then he went off to Jordan. And the following year, yes, he was there 2 seasons. The following season, I doubted whether there was an officer really good enough to get into the side, but I had to put one in because somebody had to take the rugger over from me when I left to go to India. Mm. And if he hadn't been playing in the team, he wouldn't have had much of a chance. Well, now, he was a fellow, in fact, named Campbell, who had played for his Scottish public school, so he was no
slouch.
Oh, no.
No. So the bulk of the team was made up of NCOs and other things?
Well, when I say this, that go on. So I had 2 officers playing. When we played in the... When we were beating in the final... I think the first year, a fellow named Aslett, the captain of England, was refereeing. I knew him well, and he said to me, "Eric, when you only have 1 officer playing, you'll win this bloody cup." I don't know. So it was just as they were. I did my damnedest to get more officers on the team. They just weren't good enough. The only chap I might have had was a great friend of mine, Dickie Wright, who'd been at Uppingham. Good athlete. Big chair, quite a big chair, quite fast, and I thought, by God, here we are. And I whipped him in and made him play, and after the first game he said he had a hell of a pain, and I said, oh, it's only a strain. So I got my face gloves on and massaged him, and they whipped him into hospital the following morning, took his appendix out, so that was the end of him. But no, it was just, as far as we were concerned, it was who was good enough to get in.
I see, so it was purely on merit.
Purely on merit, mm-hmm. And so I think when we won it, there was 2 or 3 lance corporals.
Yes. It's always struck me a bit that maybe relations, personal relations between officers and other ranks in the tank corps, were perhaps a little less formal and than they were in infantry and cavalry regiments, on the grounds that these people form your tank crew, you've got to work very closely to them, and this itself,
yes,
tends to break down barriers. Is there anything in that?
I don't think anything at all, really. My approach to military life is, you know, always been somewhat Prussian and disciplined. And there are certain standards, you just keep them, and there they are. Now, despite the fact that I had these chaps playing rugger, and they, you know, one's obviously very close to them, there was never any question of any familiarity or anything like that, or that they didn't take anything I said absolutely. But then I was fortunate, I suppose, in many ways, because, in fact, I had a long, long conversation on Friday night at the regimental dinner with, with one of my old rugger players who finished up as a major quartermaster. He was then a lance corporal. And he was saying, "My God, we really thought you were Christ." And of course, why these chaps thought a certain amount of me was the fact that I used to get them in the gym every night, start working them. As soon as I thought they were becoming a bit bobbery, I used to get them on their hands down, make them do press ups. Well, of course, by that time they all thought they were pretty, but either capable or tough chaps. And I could do about 100-odd press-ups with no trouble at all. It just happens that my strength of arms to weight relationship was very high, you see. whereas the normal chap, much heavier. And I could go on and I talked to these chaps while we're doing this, you see, and they were collapsing all over the place. Rather like this thing you see on, what are these champion fellas you see on television, I see them on occasion, you know what I mean? When they have to do these sort of press-ups. These chaps, and they thought, there was Offord going on, still talking. And they thought, Christ, he's a superman, probably. You know, it's just as simple as that, I think.
Now, the focus of the work of the battalion was, of course, the individual and collective training. When you joined the battalion, what was the emphasis of the tactical training? That is to say, for what was the battalion being trained? For what kind of role?
It was being trained for the encounter battle, I suppose you call it that. And this was very largely a matter of manoeuvring, preferably the whole battalion, almost like a battle fleet, to get into a position where all their guns could bear and the other chaps couldn't. Mm-hmm. Now, this, as well as that, of course, was always the approach to battle, and that sort of thing in column. But once you got on the open spaces, I think possibly Salisbury Plain did a lot of harm, because it was so good for manoeuvre of the big battalions, whereas so few places are, of course. Mm. You didn't have the great woods and forests and built-up areas in the middle of it. But at the same time, the section training, that's the lowest form of training, tactical training, which largely devoted to overcoming anti-tank weapons. This was seen as the major thing. Then such company training as we did was started to get the manoeuvre, and one section and the other, you know, manoeuvring round a flank or what have you.
Can we talk a bit about the individual training? Was this still focused, as it had been at Bovington, on driving, maintenance, gunnery?
And radio. Now, radio had come into it, you see, mm-hmm. which hadn't at Bovington.
Yes. Well, how was radio brought into it?
Well, these medium tanks had this thing called an NBMC set, which had just come in, and it worked, but it was fairly temperamental, and it did mean a certain amount of skill operating, no question.
Was it fitted to all the battalion's medium
tanks? Fitted all the tanks in then, by what, 32, 33? Mm-hmm. Mm.
And what was its range and reliability?
Well, I can't tell you really, because I would think something like 10 miles. Its reliability was variable, but on the other hand, if you couldn't get a bit from one tank, you would get it from another, you know. And this was on the move. Mm-hmm. So really, for its day and age, the first crack, it wasn't a bad effort at all. And the light tanks had the 9 or 11 set.
I see.
The longer range.
Yes.
But the individual training in the regiment was certainly not, was really most meticulous. And, you know, it was seen that every man had his individual trade training, whether it was a driver mechanic or a driver or a gunner or an operator, and then to do his second trade as well. So this was planned, and I learned a hell of a lot from the funny old men who did it, you know, the bloody great chart, literally every man's name on it. In the regiment, and it was really, it's been with me for the rest of my life, this individual training. Mm.
From the point of view of maintenance, what standard of maintenance was expected of crews, as opposed to what you could get from the workshops? Where did the division go?
Literally, from the crews, you would reckon that your first driver was the equivalent in engine, in mechanical repair